Well, good afternoon, everybody. Again, I want to thank the organizers. Ingrid is not here, but is she here? And Elizabeth, of course. And these were great presentations, so I'm in very good company. So how many were here yesterday and heard Professor Rossiter? Yeah, quite a few of them. Okay, so my approach to the topic that you will hear about today is quite similar to hers. I will talk about women scientists and engineers in Canada. This came to me after working a lot on what we call female-dominated professions. So after I looked at the nurses, the teachers, and others, I decided to do a full circle and look at those professions where there were very few women. And this is what I've been doing for the last almost, I would say, 6 or 7 years. I focus mostly on the engineers, but in many, many cases, as the story you will hear about this afternoon, we put the engineers in the scientists. So, women scientists and engineers as activists, and I put the question mark because many people are intrigued when I say that yes, they are, and they were, I'm an historian, women scientists and engineers who were activists and feminists as well, as we will see. So, I go back to Margaret Rossiter in her third volume that was published recently. And she talks about this in the U.S. context, and she describes the growing consciousness of U.S. women scientists and engineers in the late 1960s and 70s, their accelerated move towards collective action, and the creation of a women's movement in science and engineering in the U.S. So, of course, I was very intrigued by this, and then I said, yeah, I'll try to see if there was, you know, a similar development in Canada. So the goal of the presentation is to bring to light the activism of Canadian women scientists and engineers during what I call the pioneering decades of the 70s and 80s. So this is a largely unknown chapter in the history of the Canadian women's movement. I've taught Canadian women's history ever since I got to the University of Ottawa in the late 1980s. And then, of course, when I got interested in this, I realized that women scientists and engineers have largely remained outside the lens of feminist scholars in Canada, including those studying the contemporary women's movement and the development of what we call second-wave feminism since the 1960s. When I started to reread all the literature, I couldn't really find them. And then, you know, I'm wondering why this happened. And, you know, I have some hypotheses, but I think one is probably their small numbers, and especially the engineers, because quantitatively speaking, there were not a lot of women engineers when I started my study. Also, if you look at the roots of women's studies and the feminist scholarship, well, they're mainly in humanities and social sciences. So, of course, that, I think, explains also because, you know, they were not really captured by that scholarship. And also, and this is something I'm writing about now, is that there were feminist critiques of science and engineering that came from the social science humanities, and this raised fears and concerns within the larger community of women scientists and engineers. So, a little flashback to the 1950s and 60s, and I say still so few because, of course, this is something that you keep hearing about, but certainly this was a source of concern started in these decades. And the Women's Bureau, which was attached to the Federal Department of Labor, was established in 1954, headed by Marion Ross, who started to hire feminist staff, actually in the 60s. So the Bureau started to compile, analyze, and disseminate statistics on Canada's female labor force, including data on its women power. I think this is very important because the term we always used at the time was manpower. Mm-hmm. So they started to use the concept of women power at the Women's Bureau. So they wanted to show with the data how women were underrepresented in these groups, and also started to reveal through the hard data the impact of gender-based discrimination. I'm just giving you an example from a 1957 study that was published by the Bureau, where people find out that there were only 6% of professionals working the natural sciences and in engineering, but here I put the sciences first, only 6% were women, with 75% of them in chemistry and biology. Now, with engineering, and they admit that, they say that the proportion was so insignificant, it was under 1%, it was 0.7-something, that they neglected to mention it. They thought it was even worth mentioning, the place of women in engineering at the time. Again, in the 50s and 60s, it was a world of prejudice. Let's start with engineering, where there are so few of them. Elsie Gregory McGill, who was identified at the time as Canada's first women engineer. Is there the picture that appears here? Here we go. She's wearing the flapper hairstyle. This is a picture of her graduation in 1927. She was the first woman to graduate from electrical engineering at U of T. So in an interview in 1975, this was the International Year of the Women, if you remember, 1975, she gave this interview and she said, "Women engineers are still confined in a corset of Victorian prejudice." And I quote her, she then continued to say that their future is largely in the hands of the, and I quote, "male power clique that makes its decisions at the all-male engineers' table in the dining room or in the washroom." And she said, of course, she had been victim of that kind of prejudice. And in science as well, some of you may know Margaret Armour. She's still alive and kicking. Professor of chemistry, associate dean of science, diversity at University of Alberta, and a past president of CC West, as we commonly call it. And I was there at the last meeting of CC West, and she gave a great testimony to the years gone by. She was speaking to a young scientist face-to-face, and then she recalled how in the 70s, some of her male colleagues still claimed that professional women would inflict permanent damage to their children if they stayed in the paid workforce. So this is the kind of thing she heard at the time. Now, the road to activism within the community of women science and engineers, as a good historian, we try to identify triggering factors. And, you know, there are several that I have found. I'm still working on this, but an article will be published on what I'm saying today very soon in the collection. There is, of course, the seminal report of the Royal Commission on the Status of Women in 1970. And some of its key recommendation was to urge girls not to limit their career choice to one of the few lower paying and lower status female occupations. And the institutionalized women's movement that emerged following the report sought to implement these kinds of recommendations, including NAC, the National Action Committee on the Status of Women, which was a powerful feminist, national feminist lobby in the 1980s, and it campaigned successfully for the adoption of various pay and employment equity laws and policies adopted at both the federal and provincial levels. And of course, as you may remember, a major victory of NAC and of feminists at the time was in 1982, the entrenchment of principles of gender equality and employment equity in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedom. This was a very important, of course, victory for them. Other triggering factors during those decades, that is 70s and early 1980s, is that the federal government itself and many of its provincial counterparts adopted initiatives to generate enthusiasm and support for girls considering a career in the non-traditional field. That's the way they call science and engineering at the time. And politicians, and if you read the literature, it's quite clear that at the discourse level, they deplore the young women's lack of interest in science and engineering professions, and they identify this lack of interest as a very complex problem that deserves the nation's immediate attention. And the Femocrats, this is the way we identified them, these were the feminists who were hired and were quite influential in Ottawa and the federal government, especially through Status of Women Canada and the Secretary of State Women's Program. And they listened very carefully to what the politicians were saying, and they got money to distribute for advocacy work aimed at attracting more women in science and engineering. And what you have to remember is that the rationale that was given at the time was that it was seen as an issue of social justice and equality between men and women. Changing attitudes. So what I've discovered, of course, is that all these various factors led more women to envisage successful careers in science and engineering. And if you look at the data, I didn't put all the data here today, but it's clearly evident that starting in the 70s, an increasing number of women are awarded undergraduate degrees in science and engineering. I just give you an examples here for engineering and applied sciences. Well, the proportion of bachelor's degrees granted to women went up to 13% in 1989, up from 3% in 1975. So there's significant increase, especially, of course, in engineering and the applied sciences, where there were so few a decade ago. And what you also discover is that there's a growing need amongst women scientists and engineers to develop a collective identity. Many female students and women already in the profession, they feel the need to express their own voice, to join other colleagues, and to share their views and experiences with their colleagues. They yearn for greater visibility and recognition. And the major result of this is the rapid mobilization of women in science and engineering in the 70s and 80s. And to do this, they could rely on what I call the heroic generation of trail blazers. These are women who had acquired leadership and organizational skills before the emergence of what we call the second wave women's movement. There's Elsie McGill, of course, who had quite a good track record, and people forget that she was a member of the Royal Commission on the Status of Women, and according to Monique Bégin, who was a secretary of the commission at the time, she was at first the only feminist member of the committee, according to Monique Bégin. And McGill and other trailblazers, they worked very hard to promote and legitimize the concept of a women engineer, of a women scientist. So here you have a picture of Elsie up there standing left at the Toronto Business and Professional Women's Club, where she acquired a lot of expertise and experience in organization before second wave feminism. Another one I want to mention is Dormer Ellis, an engineer who became a professor of education at OISE, U of T, and she was a global activist promoting women in science and engineering around the world. Rose Sheenan, who was a professor of biology, vice president academic at Concordia University, produced a lot of articles in the 1980s, was present in major conferences to promote women in science and engineering. Ursula Franklin, she's one of my heroines, one of my favorites, I know you too. Professor of the Faculty of Applied Science and Engineering at U of T, founding member of the Voice of Women of Canada, a pacifist and feminist organization, and came from Germany, actually, after the war with a PhD in physics. On the prairies, I have to mention again Margaret Ann Armour, who was quite active early on. What's so interesting is that what I've discovered in my research is a new generation of leaders that started to appear in the late 70s and 1980s. And this new generation really spearheads the institutionalization of a women's movement in science and engineering in Canada. And certainly one of the most influential was Claudette Maquet-Lassonde, who was a graduate from the École Polytechnique de Montréal and the founding president of WISE. She had a very successful career at Hydro-Québec, Hydro-Ontario, amongst other places. And what's interesting, what gave Claudette such a big influence, she was fully bilingual. So she was able to rally the Francophones and the Anglophones across the country. And this really, it's like Micheline Bouchard, who was also a graduate of Polytechnique, who worked with her. the bilingualism gave them this asset that certainly made them very successful leaders at the time. Also, I want to mention Margaret Lo Benston and the West Coast activists. Margaret was a professor of women's studies and computer science, had moved from the United States, went to Simon Fraser. She's one of, they call themselves the Undaunted Five, and they established in Vancouver the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology in 1981. I provide the names of the others. She unfortunately passed away from breast cancer in 1991, and this is a special issue of a feminist publication, Canadian Women's Studies, that looks at her important legacy. And Claudette Maquet-Lassonde passed away very young. I was depressed, I must say. When I started writing about the lives of these two women, I was a bit depressed because they passed away very young, unfortunately. So, the links with the women's movement and feminism, that's a very important question we have to ask ourselves. If you look at Elsie McGill, Dormer Ellis, Ursula Franklin, these trailblazers were engaged in feminist activism in the 60s, late 50s, 60s, and they transmitted their feminist views and experience and feminist praxis to the new generation in the 70s and 90s. So we see these two generations actually working together at the time. And what's interesting, and this is, I just finished an article on this, is that women scientists and engineers themselves produced in the 1980s the first feminist critiques of science and technology in Canada. The same thing was happening in the US at the time. Mostly biologists were developing these feminist critiques. So Margaret Lloyd Benston was actually a seminal, wrote seminal work in that respect. Ursula Franklin in engineering. Karen Messing, who is from UQAM in biology, did important work. Roberta Mura from Université Laval in mathematics. And Anne Innes Dagg in Waterloo was a biologist. By the way, she's the daughter of Harold Innes, the famous economic historian who wrote about the staple theory. Comes from a very well-known family of academics. Okay, so were all the activists, though, feminists? Well, I always put not openly feminist, but. Is that most activists who were set up all the associations, organizations, and there were many of them that were created in the late 1970s, 1980s, were not inclined to identify themselves as feminists and to openly support institutional feminists. But Claudette Maquet-Lassonde at one point will credit the women's movement for creating, and I quote, a wave of awareness of women's ability to achieve that would compel executives to reassess women's positions within organizations. So what I came up with is that actually, if you look at the main goals pursued by Lassonde and the other leading activists, well, they're linked overall to what we call equal rights or liberal feminist and its agenda. What were they asking for? Full access to the profession, elimination of sexism, of discriminatory practices, promotion of women to positions of authority, and the recognition that women can do engineering as well as men. And finally, they were also calling for a celebration of their contributions through historical studies. So this is very close to what, when we teach feminist history, we identify as the liberal feminist agenda. But scientists, women scientists and engineers in Canada also got closer to the Canadian state starting in the late 1980s. And why is that so? Is that the federal government was becoming increasingly concerned with the nation's economic productivity in a period of rapid technological change and in the midst of a perceived threat of massive skill shortages. So the government started to publicly say that it wanted to bring more women in non-traditional occupation, especially those in science and technology. And in 1987, the conservative government of Brian Mulroney adopted Canada's first national science and technology policy. And this is a very important moment because with this new policy, the participation of women in science and engineering discursively repositioned itself as a key component of the government's projected national system of innovation. Women were clearly set in a scenario. And what we see happening is that starting in the late 1980s, there were the creation of several support programs that were designed to attract more young women in these fields. And what I found out is that Claudette Maquet-Lasson took an active part in these critical policy developments, and she was very active in trying to forge new links with the federal government. And 1987 was quite a good year for her if you look at her getting closer to power, actually political power, through these two appointments that I mentioned here. First, female vice president of the board of NSERC, and also she was a member of the newly created National Advisory Board on Science and Technology, an organization established by Mulroney and chaired by the Prime Minister, actually, himself. And Lasson is closely associated with NSERC's groundbreaking initiative in 1989, which is the creation of the National NSERC Northern Telecom Chair for Women in Science and Engineering. So as the title of the chair indicates, well, it was funded with support of the federal government and of an industrial partner. It was a university-based chair, and it was the first of its kind in the world. It would be fully devoted to the recruitment or promotion of women in these fields. I find this very interesting because yesterday Margaret was reminding us that the NSF had played a very important role in promoting women in science and engineering in the U.S. Here we have NSERC, which is a federally supported funding agency that is doing something quite similar. So I'm fascinated by the role of funding agencies at the federal level in both countries and promoting women in science and engineering. It's an interesting comparison. To finish, the Montreal Massacre, and I think we all know what I'm talking about, December 6th, for me, it clearly marks the end of the pioneering decades that I've just examined in the last couple of minutes, that is the 70s and the 80s, because clearly you see that this tragedy acted as a catalyst which propelled the problem. Now we kept talking about the problem of women in science and engineering. We still do. And we certainly did after the massacre. So it really propelled this problem in the public arena and led to renewed and more self-reflected concern for the status of women amongst members of the profession, starting with the engineers. You can understand that this was an engineering school, but also the scientists, also starting to reflect. And this quote from Ursula Franklin for me is very telling of the changes that were provoked by the tragedy. She said, "It finally became possible to speak publicly about the chilly climate, about bias, about sexism, misogyny, and patriarchy." So she did feel that it was an important turning point. So the new phase in the history of the Canadian women's movement in science and engineering thus begins, according to me, in the 1990s. And what I concluded is that in my research is that the foundations established by the women in the pioneering decades proved invaluable to the new generation of activists. So to conclude briefly, the research I've conducted so far demonstrates, according to me, the diversity and dynamic character of the larger Canadian women's movement, as well as its role in raising the consciousness of various categories of Canadian women in the 70s and 80s, including small groups of professional women, like women in science and engineering. It also sheds light on the multiple sites of feminist influence, but also on the various forms of resistance it encounters. So there is a need, according to me, to greater explore how feminism can adapt or not according to various times and places. And also, I think the research offers further evidence of the complexity of feminism and of the women's movement. And certainly now, as a historian of feminism in Canada, I see the need to depart from traditional classifications and chronologies. And I've also discovered, if I compare with the American experience, that there are specific features of Canadian, of the Canadian women in science and engineering movement. And it refers to, what I'm saying refers to the centralized and institutionalized larger Canadian women's movement, which is very distinct from the American movement in that sense. And the movement in science and engineering, led by women, tried to replicate, if you want, that model. And also, there was no such thing really as femocrats in the United States. Again, if I pursue the comparison, this is what's quite unique to the Canadian experience. And women in science and engineering benefited from their influence in the 70s and 1980s. And lastly, in the late 1980s, I just mentioned, is that the goals and agenda of the activists were increasingly served by tapping into the human resource argument. And by making alliances with government and industry, who were promoting very loudly Canada's global leadership in science and technology. You were no longer talking about social justice anymore. It was much more a human resource. We need women in science and engineering to increase the skilled labor force in Canada, what we call a human resource argument. Thank you very much.